The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Well, thank you, Christy. It's an honor to be here with you guys tonight. And as she said, I am married to Kristen. Some of you may have met Kristen before. We have an almost 11-year-old son, Hudson, and a 9-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. But if you ask her, she would say 9 and a half, and she's very insistent about it. I don't know if your kids are this way, but my daughter especially loves her birthday. To the point, last year, around New Year's, she made a New Year's resolution that she would not talk about her birthday anymore. And that came as a great relief to her mom and I, because we were sick of hearing about her birthday. So she is a girl that loves her birthday. But, tonight, I stand up here before you really as a fellow learner. I would love to say, I figured it all out, have all the answers, but most of us probably know that that's just not the case when it comes to parenting. And, there's been different times in our journey as parents where we got to the place where we thought, hey, we're really kind of in a groove here. We figured it out. And then our kids change. They move into a different stage. One of them starts teething. They go to school. Something happens that just disrupts that rhythm that you think you've worked out. I think also, working with college students for almost the last 15 years, it's kind of given me a unique opportunity to see the results of parenting. So that's both good and bad. So, whatever we're putting into our kids now, it's going to show up when they're about 18 to 22 and they leave the house for the first time. And so I've been able to see a good bit of that. And so hopefully, just tonight, some of what I've learned over the last however many years will benefit you. And so what we're going to start with is, as Christy mentioned, we're going to look at Deuteronomy 6. We're going to talk about some principles, and then there's going to be a panel that's going to get up and talk and just hear from different people. Because with a lot of things with parenting, there's not a way to do it. There's principles, but there's not a formula that you just, if you do this, everything's going to turn out right. And that's kind of disappointing at times if it were only so easy. And so to begin with, let me ask you guys a couple of questions. First of all, how many of us in here want to be good parents? Yeah, it'd probably be shocking if anybody didn't raise their hand. But how many of us feel like at times we're not doing a very good job? Yeah, that's a humbling thing, is that we feel that. And probably one of the pieces of advice I got a few years ago that's been the most helpful, that's really kind of helped take the pressure off when it comes to parenting, is a friend told me, hey, we do the best job that we can parenting so that our kids need less counseling. So it's not a question of if our kids are going to need counseling. It's really a question of how much counseling they're going to need. And so that's actually freeing. It's like, it's not, am I going to screw up my kids in some way? It's like, well, I hope I don't screw them up too bad. So maybe that's where we can jump in tonight is, hey, we're going to mess up, but we're going to ask God to really give us a lot of grace. And so to begin with, we're going to look at, what does God expect of us? And when you think about that question, it's actually surprising that the Bible doesn't directly speak to parents a whole lot. When you look at how expansive the Bible is, there are actually very few passages that directly speak to parents. Now, there's a lot of principles that are throughout the scriptures that do speak to parents. And so we're going to go a little broader than just the passages that do. And so if you've got a Bible or it's on your phone or something, pull that out. And we're going to spend a few minutes talking about Deuteronomy chapter 6. It's a pretty famous passage. It's called the Shema. It's quoted a lot. You see Jesus referring to it. But it does speak into parenting, and so that's where we're going to start tonight. So Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And so to begin with, just to make a few observations about this passage, one of the first things you probably notice is that the greatest commandment is found here in Deuteronomy 6. And so when we look ahead at Jesus in the gospel, the Pharisees have come to him, and they're asking him, hey, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus tells him, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so the Pharisees really wanted the formula. They wanted to know, hey, just give me the simple answer. But instead, Jesus gives them something much bigger and broader and expansive. No, it's love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Because even for the Pharisees, it was probably easier to not use two hands to break an egg on the Sabbath than it was to love God with all your heart. And so they were trying to trip him up. And so Jesus' reference to the greatest commandment comes from Deuteronomy 6. But what we also see in this passage is that the Jews took this passage literally. So they would write down God's commandments on little pieces of paper, and they would put it in a little pouch that they would carry around with them. Likewise, they would take these little scrolls that had the commandments on it, and they would hang it on their doorpost. So they were literally trying to take God at his word and what he's saying here just to keep the commands in front of them. And so the big idea was we need to keep the commands in front of us. And why do you think God told us that? Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One is because we forget pretty easily. It doesn't take long for us to lose focus on God and his word and drift off to other things. And so God was trying to impress upon the importance of them to be God-centered, to keep him in the forefront of their minds. And so the instruction for our families is the same. Is God is calling us as parents to be Christ-centered, to be God-centered. That's supposed to be the central thing in our lives and in our family rhythms. And so if God and Christ are supposed to be the very center, what does that mean isn't the center? Well, I think first of all, it means that we're not child-centered. Because in our culture, it's very easy to look it around at our peers and neighbors and the culture we live in and see that most people who have children, to some degree or another, orient their lives around their kids. Their kids' activities, their kids' needs. And that's not all bad. But that's not what God is calling us to. He's calling us to something different. It's to be God-centered. But also, if we're God-centered, it means we're not vocation-centered. It means that our lives are not supposed to be centered around our jobs. We're not supposed to be hobby-centered. We're not supposed to be success-centered. No, what he's calling us to is that knowing and worshiping God is supposed to be the very center of our existence. So that's the whole point of Deuteronomy 6. So what does this look like? In your home with your kids, if you just read this literally, it looks like you're just going to be sitting there and giving lectures to your kids on the commands of God. That's really not the heart of this. What it's saying is that we keep God in the center of our normal routines in life. So it's not daily lectures with your kids, but it's keeping God as the center. And so the first thing, how does that apply to us today? Well, I think it begins with us creating rhythms of worship, the word, and prayer in our homes. So as you think about what could this look like in raising a family, that's where it begins. And so for some of you guys, you may be familiar with the concept of family worship. You may not be. I wasn't until the church before we came to Park. And they really impressed upon the importance of doing family worship in the home and things like that. And so when Kristen and I first started trying to do family worship, our kids were probably 3 and 4, and it was horrible. I mean, it was the worst experience you could imagine. We would try to get on the couch, try to sing a song, get the Bible out. Kids are rolling off the couch, punching each other. Kristen's ready to give up. I'm frustrated because she's not backing me up. And the night would end with us in a conflict. And so it was like, how is this supposed to draw us closer to God? Because this just seems like the biggest waste of time ever. And so to some degree, that idea of family worship can be really daunting, and we've been there. But one of the things that really helped us was my former pastor just gave a really simple method. Hey, this is a way to do family worship. It doesn't have to be complex. He was like, sit down, say a simple prayer, sing one song. So it could be out of a hymn book. We typically do YouTube videos from the TV because none of us in our household are musicians. So we just pick a worship song or a hymn and we sing it together and then just read a little bit of scripture. So it typically might take 10 minutes. And so once we began kind of lowering the bar of what family worship had to look like, it began to become a lot more attainable. It was a lot easier. And so I think if that isn't a rhythm in your household, that's okay. Start small. You know, it's kind of like if you've gotten out of the habit of exercising, and you're like, I'm running a marathon next month. and you go out and you try to kill yourself, and you maybe get two runs in, and then you're like, I'm done. We're not doing that anymore. So it's kind of the same way with family worship. Decide what is a win. And I would say this, you know, at our most consistent over the year with our kids, we've averaged maybe twice a week. So, you know, maybe other people do a lot better than that, but for us, that's doing really good. That's a huge win just with the other busyness of life and stuff like that. So a rhythm of worship, also just a rhythm of reading the word. You know, whether you do that in the mornings, whether you do that at bedtime, whether you do it at meals, but just begin covering your kids with God's word. So when our kids were really small, what did that look like? It was the Jesus Storybook Bible. We probably read that thing till it was falling apart at the seams because they loved it. It was really helpful for them. And so it spoke to them and met them where they were at. Now, when we do, you know, any kind of Bible reading as a family, we actually use the NLT, the New Living Translation, because it's easier for our kids to understand it. It's not trying to understand harder translations, but bringing the word down to where they can experience it. And then likewise, just praying with them and in front of them. You know, prayer is one of those things for even as us as adults. You could go to a prayer seminar and you could listen to the foremost prayer expert in the world speak for a whole day, but you actually learn to pray just by doing it. And so just by doing it with your kids, you've developed those rhythms of the worship, the word, and prayer in the home. But likewise, it's not just in the home, but we're called to have rhythms of worship and community mission with the family of God as well. And so if you understand, even we at Park, what we believe about covenant membership is that you're not called to raise your kids by yourself, because as a covenant family, we're the family of God. And so part of what we're called to is to help raise each other's kids. And that's a beautiful thing, because I want people like you guys investing in my kids, and I hope to do the same in your kids. And so that's why being a part of corporate worship, that's why being committed to community, that's why being a part of living on mission with God's people matters. Because it's not just about our nuclear families, it's about our greater family, the family of God. But I will say something else about this passage in Deuteronomy 6. It's aspirational. Now, what do I mean by that? Who actually does what Deuteronomy 6 says? I mean, who in here has loved God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? We don't do a very good job at that, but that's kind of part of the point, because it reminds us of our need for the gospel. Yes, we don't, as parents, do this very well. And so it reminds us of our need for the gospel. It's not just our kids that need the gospel. And so we need to let our kids see our own needs in the gospel. We need to let them see how we fall short, just as they do. And so that's part of living out the gospel in front of your kids, is not pretending like you have it all together. You know, one thing working with young people over the last decade especially is what this generation values so much is authenticity. And so for parents who try to tell their kids what to do, but the kids don't see that authentic faith themselves, it's off-putting. That's why so many kids are turning away from the faith. And see, there's this discipleship principle of more is caught than taught. More is caught than taught. So you see it with your kids and everything. I mean, how many of us sat down with our kids and did formal instruction on how to speak? You don't. Your kids just mimic you. They imitate you. They imitate your mannerisms. They imitate everything that we do. And so it's actually the same way with passing on our faith. Your kids are going to catch more than you teach. And so that's sobering. So if we want our kids to be followers of Christ, if we want them to be passionate worshipers of God, it begins with us. Let me read this quote, and it's quite sobering. It's a lady named Kendra Creasy Dean wrote this in a book called Almost Christian. It says, since the spiritual lives and choices of American teenagers echo with astonishing clarity the spiritual lives and choices of the adults who love them, lackadaisical faith is not a young people's problem, but ours. That's sobering, because it's saying if we want our kids to love God passionately, then we've got to. It begins with us. And I think that's the big idea behind Deuteronomy 6. And so let me kind of move into some more practical principles on parenting. And you know, the hard part in preparing for something like this is the needs of for us as parents are so expansive. There's no way we could hit them all. And so I just came up with seven. Just I thought, hey, these are some things that either I've picked up on that others are. Yeah, there's some outlines on your table if you want to jot these down. But I think these are seven things that do matter. First of all, I think it's really important for us as parents to have the perspective and understand that our kids belong to God. He was the one that knit them together in their mother's womb. He was the one that ordained all of their days before the creation of the world. It is in His image that our children were created. And so what does that mean for us? It means that it's our job to steward them. They're not our kids. They're God's. And so we play a stewardship role. We're entrusted with their care and instruction for primarily for 18 years. And then obviously the relationship changes. And so the question for us, if we understand that our kids belong to God, is not who do I want my kids to be? But the question we should be asking is who does God want my kids to be as they grow up? And we get to steward them on that journey to discover who God has intended for them to be, as opposed to we're trying to make them in our own image or some image that we come up with. So number one, your kids belong to God. Secondly, begin with the end in mind. Begin with the end in mind. This is kind of vision. And it begins with just kind of asking that same question. What would please God about my son or daughter's life? Or what really matters? So think about it like this. If you could fast forward and see your kid or kids in 20 years, let's say they're super successful. They're the CEO of a company. They've got all that the world can offer. They're married. They have kids. You know, everything that our culture would say is a measure of success, they have it. But they don't love God. Is that really a win? If they had all of that, but they didn't have God, is that a win? Or maybe another way to think about it, I actually read this. There was a pastor in the UK who wrote a book about his struggle with same-sex attraction. And he was posing the question to parents. He's like, as parents, you're hopeful that one day your child's going to grow up and marry a wonderful woman or a wonderful man, and that hopefully out of that marriage is going to bring you grandkids. And that's a healthy desire. But he's like, what if you got all of that, but they didn't love God? Is that a win? And he posed the question, which is pretty challenging. What if your child grew up and they struggled with same-sex attraction for their whole life? But because they did love God, they practiced celibacy, but that meant that they never married and they never gave you grandkids. Would you be okay with that? And so that's what I'm saying, is you've got to begin with the end in mind and play it out. If your child is super successful, but they turn away from God, does it even matter? You know, I've got a good friend of mine, and I think part of the problem is that we think so short term. We think that certain things matter, but they don't necessarily matter in the long run. And so this friend of mine, he was a college baseball player. He actually went on and played in the minor leagues. I can't remember if it was for a year or two. But then by the time he was 23 or 24, he was done with baseball. And he and I were talking one day about parenting, and he was telling me, he's like, you know, as I look back on my own relationship with my father, I'm really thankful. He really invested in my baseball career. He taught me how to hit a curveball. He invested hours and hours in me as a baseball player. But it suddenly hit me one day when I'm 24 and I'm not ever going to play baseball again. I wish my dad would have taught me how to fix things around the house. Or he would have taught me how to be a man. But all of his dad's investment was in how to hit a curveball, which had a very short shelf life. So for us, sometimes we just get caught up in what's right in front of us instead of keeping the main thing, which is what Deuteronomy 6 is pointing us back to time and time again. Thirdly, love your kids. I know that sounds so simple, and you're like, well, yeah, of course. But this is why it's so important. We are the visible representation of an invisible God. So we're called to love our kids in such a way that points them to the Father. So the way we love them really does matter. Well, think about how God loves us. God pursues us in His love. God's love with us is patient. His love is kind. His love is selfless. His love doesn't keep a record of wrongs. That's the kind of love we're called to reflect for our kids. So it's all of 1 Corinthians 13. So our love, loving our kids matters because it points to the Father. Also, along with that, it's really important to give our kids physical affection. I've read some of this. I don't have all of it in front of me, but just the power of touch and the chemicals that are released and all that, it's pretty remarkable. And so giving our kids physical affection matters. Likewise, telling that your child that you love them, words matter. And here's a big thing that was really kind of changed my paradigm a few years ago, is we are called to love our children just because they are our child. So I try to tell my kids this all the time. I love you, but why do I love you? I love you because you're my daughter. I love you because you're my son. Because everything in our world is transactional based. It's you do this and this and you get this. And so if we don't love our kids unconditionally just because they're a child, then they will think that your love is conditional if they make good grades. Or they'll think that your love is conditional if they're good at sports. Or they think that your love is conditional if they're obedient. And so what we're called to do is love them just because they are our child. Also under this idea of loving your kids is just learning your child. And you probably, as adults, we're familiar with the love languages books, in that everybody gives and receives love differently. And so part of our job as a dad or a mom is to learn our kids in the way that they receive love. And then the last thing I would say under this is just support your kids no matter what. A few years ago, I got to take part in an assessment process. This guy who has a consulting company goes into corporations and stuff and, you know, assesses leaders and what do they bring to the table and all this. And as I was talking with him, one of the things he shared with me is that the people they see that have the most emotional stability are the people who felt unconditional love and support from their parents. So not support based on certain things that the parents prefer, but support based on whatever the child was interested in. So, if your child does theater, support them. If they do sports, support them. If they don't do any of that, support them. But for the children that come from parents where they feel that, it makes a huge difference in their emotional well-being. And I think with this, I heard a pastor say this a few years ago, that he really felt for parents in this generation because there's so much information out there. I mean, I did a Google search. If you want a parenting book and you go to Amazon, 60,000 results came up just for books. That's overwhelming. And if you've read any parenting books, a lot of them are like, you should do this, and you should do this, and you should do this. And it's like, I'm never going to be able to do all that. And this is one of the best pieces of advice. So if you don't hear anything else tonight, please hear this. Just love your kids. Love covers a multitude of sins. And so we can screw it up in so many ways, but if your child knows that you love them, it's going to cover so much. Number four, the power of presence. Think about this. God being present with us is huge. It started in the garden. It started with Him reaching down to us. When we sinned, it broke fellowship with God. And so Jesus coming back was His presence being with us, and ultimately eternity is going to be us being present with God. So just as our greatest need is God's presence, your kid's second greatest need is you being present with them. It's getting on the floor with them. It's engaging them in what they're interested in. And this is probably convicting for all of us. It's when you're with your kids, putting our phones down and being all there with them. I mean, nothing is going to communicate value more than when you put everything else away and you're fully engaged with your child. Make memories with them. Plan memories, traditions. You know, one of my kids' favorite things, and honestly one of my favorite things, is years ago we started a Saturday morning tradition called Cinnamon Roll Saturday. And so every Saturday morning, I know I got to have some cinnamon rolls ready because my kids are expecting it, but it's fun and we love it. So there's those planned things that you can do with your kids that make memories, but also just being present so you don't miss the spontaneous ones. And, you know, honestly, some of you guys are aware that my family's gone through some pretty hard things in the last couple of years. And as part of a result of that, both my wife and I have been dealing with PTSD. I've been battling depression for about a year and a half. And so if you can relate to any of that, you know there's a lot of days where it feels like just getting out of the bed is all you can do. And with that, with parenting came this tremendous amount of guilt and shame that we weren't giving our kids what they needed. I'm so thankful we had a counselor who was helping us kind of walk through this season. And she told me that, you know, studies show that your kids need 5 minutes of undivided attention daily. So if that's all you can give them is 5 minutes, there will be enormous benefits. So maybe your season of life is you're just working and in the go or whatever, but 5 minutes. I think all of us can give them 5 minutes a day of undivided attention. Fifthly, parenting is not about you. So I've thought this, I'm sure you've thought this, but hey, I want to be a great dad or mom. There's books, you know, according to that. But what's wrong with that idea? It's very subtle, but it's very off. When you think like that, the focus is on self. It creates a pressure for you to perform as the parent. So, hey, I've got to have it all together. I've got to be good. I've got to be great. It doesn't allow you to be imperfect and to fail when you're focused on being great. But think about this. When the focus is on you, when the focus is on being a good parent, it creates this pressure for your kids to have it all together as well. So think about their behavior. If they have bad behavior in public, that now becomes a reflection on you and you as a parent. And so you may lash out, you may get angry, you may discipline your child because they embarrassed you and it reflected on you. You don't shepherd their heart. You know, maybe this is something you've dealt with. Maybe one of your kids looks at you one day and is like, I don't love you, or you're a mean mom, or something like that. I probably said that to my mom a few times. And there is a realness to that where that hurts a little. That stings. It's like, do you have any idea what all I do for you on a daily basis? And you would say that to me? But here's the thing. They're a child. They're a child. They don't know what they're saying. They don't mean what they're saying. And so part of us is we've got to understand that we don't need our child's validation. If in our own lives we're God-centered, we're Christ-centered, and we're viewing our child that it's just our job to steward them, then they can say what they want. It doesn't matter. I'm still going to love them the same. So if your child tells you, I don't love you, you can just respond and say, that's okay, because I'm always going to love you. And you move on. But when parenting is about you, that stuff now all of a sudden becomes a scorecard for you. So that's fifth. Sixth, God has entrusted you with the primary responsibility of teaching and training your kids. So whatever you do, you're training your child. You know, you see this from the time they're babies. One of the first things you do as a parent is training your child to sleep, right? So if your child's having trouble sleeping and you set them on the dryer, on the bouncy seat to try to get them to sleep and it works, you're like, oh, that's great. What's the problem with that though? Now you've trained them that they need to be on the dryer vibrating to go to sleep, right? Same thing. I saw it with my brother with his kids. His kids had to be in the bed with him and his wife until they were like four. That wasn't good for their marriage. So, you know, if your kid has to be in the bed with you, you know, you can do that however you want. I'm not trying to tell you how to do it. But my point is, whatever you do, you're training your kid. And so, you know, if you let your child stand on the table at home, it's cute, it's funny, but then what about when they go to a friend's house or grandma's house and they stand on the table? Now they're getting mixed messages. Why can't I do this at home but not here? You're training your child. So we're called as parents to teach them about God, about life. And here's a couple things I would encourage you guys on. If you don't teach them, they're going to learn from somewhere. So if they don't hear anything about life from you, they're going to find out about it from somewhere else. The kids on the playground, that's not a good place to learn. You know, I mean, I can remember being in the fourth grade. I grew up in Mississippi in the 1980s. So this is a conservative part of the country, a more conservative time. And I remember learning in the fourth grade what oral sex was on the playground. I didn't have a clue. My parents were way behind the curve on that. And so here's the thing. Let them learn from you, because if they don't, they're going to learn from somewhere else. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to, you know, young adults in their 20s, who say, I wish my mom would have talked to me about this, or I wish my dad would have taught me this. They really do want to hear it from you as opposed to their buddy on the playground. And then secondly, or lastly with that, is just talk to them sooner rather than later. Especially in the culture with technology and everything we live in today, it would be better to talk to them about something too early than too late, right? Sometimes this can backfire on you. It was about a month ago, and my wife and I, it was Saturday morning, we were trying to sleep in, and all of a sudden, my son comes in, and he's kind of got his whiny tattle voice. He goes, "Mom, Dad," Elizabeth talking about his sister, he goes, "Elizabeth called me an asshole." We're like, "Oh," and then we're like, "Did he?" And then we kind of looked at each other and we're like, "Well, he probably was being one because he tends to do that with his little sister." But then he proceeds to say, "Yeah, she called me like that like six times." And we're like, "Okay, well, Elizabeth, where did you learn this?" She goes, "Well, I learned it from Hudson." And we're like, "Okay, well, where'd you learn that word, Hudson?" And then he goes, "Well, I learned it from you, Dad." And I was like, Kristen looks at me and is like, "What is going on here?" But actually, they did learn it from me because one night we're sitting around the dinner table and they're asking me about four-letter words and cuss words. And so I proceeded to tell them, "Hey, here's the words that are kind of swear words." And I did tell them, "Hey, we don't use those words, but I would rather even something like that, they learn it from us than learn it from their buddies on the playground." But be careful. You never know when it's going to come back out. So at least it wasn't in, Park Kids or something, one of you guys teaching them. Lastly, with the whole idea of teaching them is the role of authority. I think this is so huge in our world, is that helping them understand that God is the ultimate authority. God has designed the world with authoritative structures for our good and flourishing, and that you as the parent are an extension of God's authority, and so obedience is to be expected. That's not a popular concept, that's not the normal, but that's true, and that's part of God's design. And so that leads us into the last one, 7. Your kids need discipline. It's true. If you could imagine a world without authority and discipline, it would be a world of chaos and anarchy. And so God has intended it to be that way, that there's discipline and authority. And so we reflect the love of the Father when we discipline our kids. And discipline is not about punishment. It's about instructing and correcting your child's heart in order to lead them to God or back to God. So in a real sense, it's very similar to the role of elders in a church. It's their call to shepherd and safeguard and lead us back at times. And so, your kids actually do want discipline. My wife and I were doing some premarital counseling with a couple last month. And we were asking them about their childhood and their background and stuff like that. And it was interesting. The girl in this relationship said that, she, in her family, only her mom disciplined, her dad didn't. And it really made her sad because she wanted her dad to discipline her. And because he didn't, it communicated that he didn't care. Like this, she said she recognized that even as a teenager, is that discipline and being engaging is a sign of actually, I do care and I do love you. And so here's the thing, discipline is not about you. It's not about us as parents venting our anger or frustration. It's not to be done when it's convenient. I can't tell you how many times it's like, it would be more convenient just to let this go right now than to address it. And here's the thing, you can choose discipline methods. I'm not about to tell you what to do, but this is the best advice on discipline I ever got. Make it hurt. So make it hurt. I heard a story of a guy telling me his kids were fighting over Halloween candy, and he told them, "If you guys argue over this again, we're dumping it all in the trash can." They argued again. Guess what he did? He followed through. He dumped all of their Halloween candy in the trash, and they never argued over Halloween candy again. So here's the thing. You just got to make it hurt. So, with my kids, one of them, if I ground them from sweets, it's a huge deal. The other one could care less. But the other one, if you take away screen time, that's devastating. So you've got to know your child and know what works. And, I've heard this story. I don't remember this personally, but apparently I was an ornery child. In kindergarten, I kept getting in trouble. And I guess the way they did discipline was if you got in trouble, you went and sat in the corner in time out and didn't have to do your work. And so one day, my mom overhears my brother and I talking. And my brother's asking me, why do you get in trouble so much? And I'm like, well, if you get in trouble, you don't have to do your work. You just get to sit in the corner and chill. And little did I know that she overheard me and then quickly had a conversation with the teachers, but the discipline didn't hurt, and so it wasn't effective. It didn't lead me back. And so I would say there's two other things, is come up with a discipline plan ahead of time, not in the heat of the moment. So if in the heat of the moment you're frustrated, that's not the time when you're thinking clearly. And then likewise, consistency is really important. You know, say what you mean what you say. You know, I can see, think back, especially when our kids were smaller, and when they started acting out, we would get really frustrated. And usually when we got frustrated, it was a sign that we had been inconsistent with our discipline. It was on us, not them. It was our fault. And so let me give you a couple of just dangers in parenting, and then we're going to get the panel up here. Number one, I think there's a real danger of finding your worth in your parenting choices. It's a self-righteous pursuit. It's ultimately idolatry. But I've seen this play out so much through the years, how certain things almost become a secondary gospel. So let's take the food that you feed your kids. Obviously, we live in a city and a world where there's a lot of different ideas on nutrition and dieting. And here's the thing. Before the Lord, it's your job to feed your kids in a way before Him that you feel is good. But there isn't a gospel of you should follow this certain diet. Same thing with education. You know, if one day you choose to send your kids to public school, private school, homeschool, charter school, whatever else, that's between you and the Lord. But there is not one of those that is more righteous and holy before the Lord. And so, but I have talked to many people who've thought, well, if you don't have your kid in a Christian school, you don't love God. And then I talked to another person, and they're like, well, if you don't have your kid in public school living on mission so that other kids can know Christ, you're not doing your job as a Christian. And then you talk to somebody else, and it's like, well, if you don't have your kid homeschooling, you really don't love your kid. And it's like, well, if you listen to all three scenarios, you're going to be really confused, because everybody that chooses one of those methods has compelling reasons. And that's your option and opportunity to do that before the Lord, but it's not a secondary gospel. Thirdly, same thing with discipline choices. It's not a secondary gospel. You know, spanking, not spanking, all those things can be very controversial. But one is not more righteous or more holy than another. There is only one gospel. And so that leads us to the second danger, being critical of others who do things differently. It kind of begins with comparison. It's like, they were letting their kid drink a Coke. Can you believe that? It's like, it sounds funny, but we do that. It's like, they let them watch what? And then we pass judgment on them. And then we exalt ourselves and we begin to tear others down and being critical because they're doing it different. That's especially destructive within the family of God. We're supposed to be for each other. We're supposed to be helping each other, not tearing each other down. Thirdly, living vicariously through your kids. That's a huge danger. You know, we're called to help our kids find their own way. I like this analogy. As parents, we're called to help our kids spread their wings, not clip their wings, not try to get them into a box of our design. We're called to embolden them to discover who God has made them to be, and then to help them take risk to live that out. But I've seen it too often in different ways, whether it's grades, education, whatever. But kids are crushed by their parents trying to live vicariously through them. And then fourthly, not challenging the culture or the cultural values. We don't just swallow what the culture is selling without challenging it. I was reading this recently. It's in Tim Keller's book, Counterfeit Gods. He talks about the idolatry of success. And this is so big in our culture. And this is what he says. Modern society, then, puts great pressure on individuals to prove their worth through personal achievement. It is not enough to be a good citizen or family member. You must win, be on top to show you are one of the best. David Brooks' book on Paradise Drive describes what he calls the professionalization of childhood. From the earliest years, an alliance of parents and schools created a pressure cooker of competition designed to produce students who excel in everything. Brooks calls this a massive organic apparatus, a mighty achievatron. The family is no longer what Christopher Lash once called a haven in a heartless world, a counterbalance to the dog-eat-dog areas of life. Instead, the family has become the nursery where the craving for success is first cultivated. And, you know, that's pretty sobering. But I've seen it on the college campus too. I mean, probably if you ask me in almost 15 years of working with college students, what I've seen change is the anxiety levels of kids. At the School of Mines, just 13 miles west of us, the first week of school, an 18-year-old freshman committed suicide because of the pressure and the expectations to excel and achieve and perform. And so let's be willing to challenge the culture when it comes to the Achievatron. If nothing else, make your home, as he said, a haven in a heartless world. And so I'm going to close with this, just a vision for raising kids today. Obviously, we live in a very secular city. It's a city where you can't count on the culture to reinforce a Christian worldview or point your kids towards God. But think about this. For most of the last 2,000 years, the church has thrived and flourished the most when we've either been a minority or we've been persecuted. That's when the church has thrived, and that's where we find ourselves today. We are an overwhelming minority in our country, in our city now, of people who truly know and understand the gospel. And so here's the thing. That's when the church has thrived. And so two things. One, it's going to make us go to prayer even more because we don't have cultural help. We've got to depend on God. And then secondly, we need the family of God. We need each other. If our kids are going to be getting reinforcing that pushes them back to God in the Bible, we've got to be helping each other do that, not just everybody's out for themselves. And so I would say as you think about raising kids in Denver, there are a lot of things that could overwhelm you. But there's also a lot of reasons to be hopeful and to have vision. So could I have, if you're on the panel, come on up. And I'm going to pray and kind of close out my time as these guys are coming up. Father, we thank you just for your word and for that we don't have to stand alone, that you have given us Christ, you've given us your presence, you've given us the gospel so that we don't have to be perfect and have it all figured out. And so, God, we thank you for that and just pray that you would give us a lot of wisdom and grace in this whole parenting endeavor. And likewise, God, you would help our kids just to know you, that God, they would be protected from what sin will do to their lives. And God, you would help us. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Chuck, a round of applause, please. That was really helpful.
If y'all want to keep the mic, I'm going to moderate the discussion. And so maybe to start with, just real quickly introduce yourself and where your kids are, age-wise, that kind of thing would be great.
Okay. I'm Terry Skelton. This is my wife, Nancy Skelton. We have five kids. We have our oldest is 30. And our youngest is 12, so quite a spread. We raised one family, and then we adopted a couple of girls and are raising them. So we're doing the. I guess we didn't get it right the first time.
Hi, we are Chance and McKaylee Co. We have two little boys. Our oldest is 2. Our youngest just turned 1. They are 16 months apart and lots of fun. So,
anything else? Get a clap for them now, too.
We're Tony and Sarah Julianelle, and we have an almost 12-year-old, 9-year-old, and a 5-year-old.
My name is Jacob, and this is my wife, Liz. We have 3 boys, 7, 5, and 2.
Well, the first question, and probably for time's sake, maybe only have 2 couples a question answer, and then we'll keep going and get to more of the questions. But how do you best handle outright defiance in a gospel-centered, loving but stern manner? There's kind of a follow-up question, similar vein, but just how do you handle deliberate disobedience? So you got the mic, you'll start.
All right. Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember, at least for me and my wife when we're parenting, is, you know, our kids were born sinners, and they have a sinful nature. And they oftentimes, it's an unbridled sinful nature, whereas we're very good at hiding it. They are not. And I want to teach my children, the gospel in the midst of that and say, this is outright defiance. I want to be clear, consistent, have communication. But at the same time, I want them to understand that you have a heart that is rebelling against us, that is rebelling against God, and I want to bring the gospel to bear in that situation. So.
That was pretty good.
I can give an example that just happened. I'll give a quick example. We were driving home from Albuquerque last night because we went to the balloon festival and saw no balloons. When our two-year-old woke up from his car nap, he was angry and he kicked his brother in the face, who was also sleeping. Who then wasn't sleeping anymore. So I asked him to apologize to his brother, and he just could not for the life of him. He was like crying, hysterical, saying, I can't. That he couldn't say he was sorry. And in those instances, when I see that like dark side of his heart, I like sympathize with him. I'm like, buddy, I know it's hard. Like, I know you don't want to say you're sorry. Like, I totally relate to that. But I also ask him, like, why don't you want to say you're sorry? And of course, he's only 2 years old, so he doesn't really know. But just try to, like, talk through it, I guess, and be patient to reaching an outcome.
We'll go on to another question, maybe Skelton, if you guys would take this one. But what are some basic frameworks for incorporating worship into our daily family life?
We're in the car a lot. So I guess Christian radio is huge for us in the car. And my girls, it's a blessing to hear them sing along in the back seat for me. And I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. So I think that's a huge part in our lives now. A lot of us are in the car a lot, so take advantage of what you're listening to in the car, because they definitely pick that up very quickly in their hearts, I think. So, and then I like to leave Christian radio on in the house, and, you know, my daughters are at age 12 and 13 now where they want to pick it up a little bit, you know, with Way FM or something. So I had kind of a hard time with that. And I thought, you know, this is speaking to their hearts. And this is good. It's not just about me and being an older parent and being more comfortable with the music, but this is really touching them right now. I think that's been a big thing for me, is just the music that really speaks to their heart the way some other things can't, I think. So, yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Julian, Ellis, you guys want to take a shot at that one?
I think one thing we've found, we had a similar experience to Chuck when our kids were young, just family devotion time being crazy, kids like diving off the couch and hitting their heads on the table, and you're just like, oh, what are we doing? So we've found doing it at the dinner table. It's just like a simple thing that's really helpful because you kind of have their captive attention. Also, keeping it short is really helpful for this age. And like you said, I think, you know, if we're averaging once a week, we're feeling good about that. You know, some weeks more, sometimes it's a few weeks before we haven't done it. So I think just giving grace to ourselves and just being consistent and keep doing it.
That's great. All right, new question. Just lost it. Basically, it was asking, in Denver, with so much to do, how do you build in healthy family rhythms where you have margin and time for things that matter and that type of thing? So whoever wants to do this one.
This is something I'm pretty passionate about, so I can answer. I think our culture, especially as your kids get older, is just constantly being busy. And so I feel like we have to fight against that. And so we really work at, this will probably come later for a lot of you in the room, but like one activity at a time or no activities, definitely not all the time to even do an activity. And I feel like we're just constantly fighting against that it's not the norm, but just leaving space for our kids to play in the evenings, for our families to connect, mm-hmm. for us to have the conversations. I think it's easy to be so busy that you're not having the conversations that your kids need to be having with you. So, anybody else?
Yeah, I think what Sarah, like, just decide ahead of time and then apply your decisions. So it's like, how do I say no? It's like, well, when she says activity, it's like our kids don't play a sport and do something else or play two sports. And sometimes that's hard, but they know the decision. They kind of know how that works in our family. So decide what nights you're not going to have something going on, and then don't do something. When something comes up, and it's that whole, like, make the decisions early and then apply them to your life. So I think that, thanks to Sarah, has been good for our family.
What would you guys say, because, you know, it may make sense, like, don't play three sports at one time or something like that, but what if, when it comes down to, they have mandatory school activities and gospel community and hanging out with friends or park teams, you know, so good things. How do you even kind of weigh that out?
Yeah, I think it's hard. We're fortunate that there aren't a lot of mandatory school activities. We're fortunate that, you know, one thing we're intentional about at Park is that we're not really over-programmed at Park Church. So if you wanted to be here every night of the week, you could be, but the doors would be locked. So I think how you choose to order your life around those things, and sometimes it's hard to say no to things that feel like, I mean, I think one of the big things for us is, like, what are our kids missing out on, right? And it's like, man, I don't want them to miss out on this thing at school or miss out on this thing at church or miss out on this thing with their friends. But what they are missing out on then is your family and what's going to be most formational for them. So, I'll just say lots of pressure. So lots of grace around that pressure. But for us, it was easier to decide ahead of time and not have to decide on every request. Like, can we do this? It's like, sorry. I'll give you an example. We're going away this weekend with our family, and we got an invitation to a birthday party. Oh man, do we cancel our plans as a family so one kid can go to a birthday? But no, we already decided we're going, and that child is upset that she's going to miss out on a birthday party, and that's just an opportunity to let her know that life's full of disappointment. So.
And I think as we approach teenage years, which are with our daughters, it actually gets harder. You have to be intentional with the time that you have as a family. And again, when they get to be high school aged, it's really tough because there's a lot going on. They have school activities, sports activities. But I think it's very important as a family to carve out a time that they understand is a precious time as a family. We need, and I think for us, mealtime is one of those things. As much as possible, we have meals together. And I know a lot of families don't do that, and there's no right or wrong. But I would just say you need to be able to carve out that time, especially when your kids get older, so that they're connected with their family. And again, our society has a lot of choices and freedoms.
We had family encourage us. Sorry, when we were young parents, just to hold Sunday. And we didn't want to be legalistic or anything about that, but we still said, you know, Sunday's our family day, and we don't plan. We really avoided sports that do Sunday sport games. I know that's a hard decision, but we said we're not going to do things that take you away on Sunday. And that means we don't do sleepovers on Saturday night. We save those for another time, but Sunday's our day as a family, and we don't go anywhere unless we're all together or we are home, but we don't, one doesn't go off and then mom's not going to taxi you around on Sunday. So we set that up early in our parenting years, and we stuck to it for a long time. So I think that advice that our in-laws gave us was just precious because, you know, we really wouldn't have thought of that. And the pressure around us is so much. Like, Sunday's just another day now. And really, we just treasure that now because they would join in and we would think of things to do together on that day. And we would know that, okay, well, I got invited to that, but I know I can't because that's our family time. So that was probably some of the best advice we ever had. Yeah.
New question, and I'm hoping this is for parents with small kids, but any advice for not losing your cool during tantrums? So hopefully that's not any 10-year-olds that's the case for. So.
We were actually just talking about this recently. One of the main things that I try to do during tantrums is like slow down time for myself. So instead, like every bit of angst and anxiety that he has, I try to like decrease it for me. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I just kind of have time moving more slowly for me, and I automatically let go of whatever is ahead. So if we need to like be meeting friends at the park, or I was trying to get to story time or whatever it is, I like let go of that because that causes me more anxiety, and just like live in this moment and it will be over. So just try to slow down like what's going on inside of me and not let his anger and tension become mine, that I can be like the calm baseline, I guess, that he can come back to. And I'm not perfect at it by any means, but that's like my goal, I guess, is to just slow my insides.
I'll be honest, there's been plenty of times where I've just lost it. I think the main thing that has been good for me in parenting is knowing that that's normal. Those times where Jake comes home and I said, like, I screamed back at them and I was in tears and they were in tears and it looked awful.
I love coming home to that.
That's not every night, no. But... yeah, and we'd done a bit of that pool trip stuff and watched those videos that Christy had shared, and I think that was sort of a bit of a change around for me, realizing that I was witnessing the gospel in my forgiveness, in my need for forgiveness, when my inability to have patience or my desire for them to have a quiet half an hour before daddy gets home was disrupted. So often it's about my heart with a tantrum. So God's been really gracious and grown me in that, and that's what's really changed in terms of me taking, seeing that with the boys. what was the other thing I was going to say? Yes, modeling forgiveness. And I've seen it in our boys. They really do. I see them forgive each other because I've modeled it, and my family, kind of like Chuck was saying, my family never modeled that forgiveness. Everything was kind of shoved down and not talked about, and it's really beautiful to watch the kids kind of apologize to each other, not always instantaneously, but I think that they, you know, we talk about what Jesus does and has done for mummy and how that's true for them too, isn't it?
I think for me, when I respond negatively to tantrums from my children, which again are normal, and we all have friends where their children don't seem to have tantrums, that's not normal, but we all seem to have that friend. So I think for us, especially for me, you're them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we're not going to hang out. We'll feel bad. No. I think for me, when I kind of lose my cool when my kids are having a temper tantrum, it is really because they're inconveniencing me. You know what, I just wanted to come home, I wanted to relax, or it's Saturday, we're all enjoying time together, and your temper tantrum has thrown a wrench in the whole thing, and now I'm angry at you because you ruined my time. Rather than thinking of it as a way of, hey, this is a great time to help my child understand what's going on in their hearts and how to have repentance and, you know, how to calm down and control your emotions, really I'm just thinking I didn't get to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. So it's Most of it's with me when I lose my cool with my children.
All right, new question. Any tips for keeping marriage healthy prioritized with small children? But I think that could continue on, even Julianne's and kids are talking about when kids get busy as they're older. So how do you keep marriage a priority and healthy while raising kids?
My wife and I never liked the idea of date nights, and then that changed as we had more children. So we always thought, like, we know we're not that couple. We are that couple. So that's all I got.
I work out a lot. These rhythms are really important for us. So did some people actually think I work out a lot? Because I don't. But as your kid, I think, and to something earlier, just like as we were talking about rhythms of life and like just understanding, like when your kids, we see this all the time, our kids are just ahead of us. And I think you made a great point, like family time with your kids when they're younger looks different than when they're teenagers. And understanding developmentally what your kids need, they probably need less of you in their teenage years. They need more of their peers. And I don't mean their peers are forming them, but just understanding kind of brain science and how that works and their need for those peer connections. So just really affirm, like, just be, there isn't one way to do that, like cradle to college, right? Sarah's been awesome in our relationship over the last 12 years since we've had kids. Of really, the date night thing's a big deal. The other thing we've started doing recently, our kids are now at the age where they would much rather be with their cousin Audrey than with us. And like they get really excited when she's there. So for us to take like a 24-hour block and leave, and it's just has been really life-giving for us to say, we're just going to go somewhere. We're going to leave on Saturday at noon, and we're going to come back for church on Sunday, and do that periodically a few times throughout the year is just an amazing way to slow down and get away. And the kids have a great time because they're with someone they love being with, and we get to reconnect and be intentional. So that's one thing we've done.
I was just going to go back to the tantrum thing real quick. One thing I was thinking about that was really helpful for us is we learned a lot. Our oldest son was adopted, and so we learned a lot about brain science, which I don't think is like a typical thing that a lot of young parents learn about, and we were really grateful for that because I think one thing to realize when they are throwing a tantrum is they're not in the rational part of their brain, and you can feel yourself when you're getting upset going to this part of your brain that's not rational, that you can't talk down. And so I think really helping them calm down and saving consequences and saving even more discussion type things for once they are calm, I feel like that has helped us so much. And our kids are a lot older and their tantrums look different, but they definitely have their ways of throwing fits. So
I was actually going to say something else about tantrums really quick too. One thing that I try to do is like catch him at the start of the tantrum, and we're still figuring out what works, but things like taking deep breaths or like just whatever different kind of things that we can like cut it off before we get to the irrational part. If we can even talk about it before we hit the irrational part. But you want to talk about being intentional?
Yeah. So going back to prioritizing your marriage. So, if you guys are in the thick of it, you know that this is really hard, or it's been at least our experience. Like, we would love to be the date night people, I think. So just to kind of paint the picture a little bit. So I'm in class 2 nights a week. We lead a gospel community, and between making disciples of other people and church and family, and we also rent out 3 of our bedrooms to 3 other adults. So it's like, there's a lot of people around all the time, and it's like, how do we have time for ourselves when we've got all these people and all these other things going on? I'm not even home half the evenings of the week. So, yeah, we would love to be the date night people, but we're learning what that looks like. So one of the things that we've attempted, and again, we're still learning, is after bedtime, after we put the boys down, we'll take 10 minutes and just kind of talk about the day. And
even if there are dirty dishes.
Right, yeah. Even if there's still, you know, leftovers sitting up in the kitchen, we're going to take 10 minutes and we're going to talk about just highs and lows of the day, just what's going on in our lives. So we're learning, I think we're learning, okay, the small things actually matter, at least for us. So being intentional with 10 minutes even, or, you know, I try to be intentional to be sure I go straight to McKaylee whenever I come home, because I want to, one, but also, like, I know that shows her value. So finding those small things to show value to your spouse. And we also recently took a trip where we had, what was it, 6 days, 5 days?
Shout out to my parents.
Right, yeah, they're here tonight. Left the boys with the in-laws, and we had 6 days to ourselves, and that was incredible. So if you have that opportunity, I understand that's not the norm, but if you can, that was like, it was like, oh, I actually have a wife, and I'm married, and like I love her. So that was really good for us.
All right, new question. How have you balanced loving guests well in your home while having young children with all of their teaching and training needs?
Can you guys speak to that one?
We have some people in our house. Basically, I've chosen to see teaching and training our kids as like discipleship opportunities. So a lot of the people that we have over to our house are either single or young and married and don't have kids. So I just do whatever I would normally do and consider it discipleship, like doing life with us, seeing what life looks like, and not that I'm doing it perfectly by any means or that we are, but I mean, we have people in our house all the time, so they see us have arguments. They see us like interact with our kids and be angry. And it's just more opportunity to see, I guess, the gospel at work, how we reconcile with each other, with our kids, and just continue on with regular life. So yeah, for people who aren't familiar with having kids, I just treat it like that. Like I'm just letting them see what our real life is like. I don't like make it any different. And then with other parents, I assume they know what it's like, so they're going to be okay with it.
We used to be involved in like a church plant in England where we were doing a lot of community together. So we used to have lots of meals, well, gospel community stuff, but we were really in each other's lives. And I think I kind of learned, I loved doing that, but I also learned some stuff through that. One of our kids is quite socially anxious. So when our house gets filled with people, he kind of, he just has really difficult behavior. And I was kind of like, yeah, fill our house with people and show them Jesus. And then we realized and kind of learned from that we had to do the best thing for him as well. And so we sort of talked that through with him, and he said, yeah, I get really anxious when our house has too many people or too many kids are playing with all my toys and things. So I think we kind of take it week by week in terms of when we can have people over and how they're doing and how much time we've spent with them. But I've definitely realized that he also needs to have, you know, Jesus' love as well as me filling my house with lots of people I want to know Jesus.
That's great. Almost out of time. There was one more question just about where do you find good parenting resources like books and videos? And I would just say, you know, like I mentioned, if there's 60,000 resources out there, you probably just need to pick a couple. So talk to somebody who would recommend something. And it would be better to just do one or two, read one or two books or resources and do those than try to do so many, because it is really overwhelming, especially when you have small kids and that kind of thing. So I actually brought a couple of the books that were most helpful for Kristen and I. And one is called Shepherding a Child's Heart. Some of you guys may be familiar with that one. That was super helpful. If that was one book I'd recommend, it'd probably be that one. And then these two books, one is for boys, one is for girls. They're actually written by some child psychologists, therapists, I think based out of Nashville. But they actually take a child's development, both physically, mentally, spiritually, and kind of help you understand what their needs are in each stage. So these are two books. The boys is called Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys. And then the girls is All You Need to Know About Raising Girls. And these are books we still reference pretty often. So For time's sake, we're going to conclude the evening, but I know I'll be able to hang out. I don't know if any of the panel can hang out longer if you didn't get your questions answered. And Christy, anything else for tonight?
Can I just add one thing? So Jason Jones and I have been working on a book that will be available later this year. It's called Parenting from the Sofa, How to Raise Your Voice and Lower Your Expectations. And we'll send an email out about that. So shout out to JJ. It'll be up on the bookshelf, right next to Trip.
Great.
Right next to all Trip stuff.
Good. Well, thank you guys for being here tonight, and have a good evening. Thank you.